Hello, everybody. Welcome back to episode 63 of UFO Encounters Worldwide. This is your host, Jesse Peek, MUFON field investigator in the state of Pennsylvania, city of Philadelphia. Today, we have a very special guest, Alan B. Smith. He's the researcher of the paranormal, high strangeness, and ufology. He is a podcaster with his YouTube channel called Mystic Lounge, where he has two shows, Paranormal Now and Coffee and UFOs. He is also a documentary filmmaker, which we'll be talking about his new documentary that just dropped called Half-Light. So we have a lot of information to go over, so strap on them seatbelts. We're going for a ride. Welcome to episode 63 of UFO Encounters Worldwide. This is your host, Jesse Peek, MUFON field investigator in the state of Pennsylvania, city of Philadelphia. And today's episode is sponsored by ERRT Radio. You can go check out their weekly shows over at YouTube, and they're also on the Mixlr app. Today we have very special guests. We have Alan B. Smith. He is a podcast host, a researcher, and a documentary filmmaker with his new documentary called Half-Light. So, Alan, welcome to the show today.
Hey, Jesse. Thanks for having me, man.
Absolutely. This is exciting, man.
I'm a big fan of yours, and we're becoming, I guess friends in a sense, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I consider you a friend 100%. Good friend.
Totally. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I feel the same way. It's been an absolute pleasure getting to know you.
Yes. It's pretty crazy how it happened. And now it's on your show, and you just had a pre-screening of your documentary, and now you're on my show. We get to have another conversation and kind of on your side.
Oh, yeah. I love the UFO fellowship.
Absolutely. It is good when it's nice and positive, for sure.
Right. Yes. Good point.
I really don't know, but how did you get into this field? Where did it all start for you, where you started getting into the UFO subject and the high strangeness stuff? Like, where did that start?
I think, like most of us, it's not just one thing in particular. The most influential film on my life, hands down, was E.T. the Extraterrestrial. It's still my favorite movie of all time. But the event that I experienced of a CE1 encounter was when a friend of mine and I were in the backseat of a car when we were about 12 years old. Our parents were driving down a highway. It's called the Poor Man's Highway, which runs parallel to the Garden State Highway. And it was called Poor Man's Highway because you didn't have to pay tolls. And it was a really slow but beautiful drive. And that night it was really clear. The stars, were out. This is in the Pine Barrens in New Jersey.
Okay.
And so, it's just a gorgeous drive. So we're, looking up at the stars, and I don't remember what we were talking about. We're kids, and we both saw two what looked like stars kind of in the fore. So they looked offset from the star field itself. And they were moving then against the field, slightly, right. And one of them that I remember in particular streaked across the sky. So it was, one like from left to right, stops on a dime, and then streaks back, stops on a dime, and then goes in reverse, like a shooting star going in the wrong direction. So, and he and I remember it slightly differently. But I remember after that incident, it hit so hard that I told myself as a 12-year-old, and I think I was 12, it was like 11-ish, 12, right around there. I told myself that I can't forget this event. Like, I have to remember this because I'm a kid and I know what happens. People grow up, they become adults, and they don't believe kids.
Absolutely.
And I remember just having this thought, maybe I saw something in a movie or, conversations around parents or who knows what. But, and then not my parents were, they were never, it's sort of to kind of like, push you down. Like, they're very open to letting our imaginations run wild. But this wasn't an imagination. This was something that we really did see. And there was two of us. And I didn't want to forget it. So year after year after year, I just reminded myself as I grew up, don't forget, this was real. This was real. This is not something you imagined, and it put me on that trajectory of a sincere, enthusiastic interest in anything related to UFO, but also paranormal phenomena as well. And then shortly after, a couple of years later, The X-Files comes on television, and that becomes, you know, a sort of ritual for my mom and I. We both loved watching that show, and that had a huge impact on me as well. And during that time in the 90s, it was really exciting. I mean, super, super exciting.
Right.
It was exciting, as it is for many, with the beginning of the New York Times reveal in 2017 of ATIP and eventually OSAP and the UAP phenomena. Because at that time, in the late 80s going into the early 90s, the Roswell incident, the Corona crash, had exploded across the media, talk shows, books, movies, documentaries. You know, many in the fore of the research, like Stanton Friedman, was just a really good spokesperson for the sincere scientific research.
Yes, and absolutely. He was one into, of my favorites.
Yeah. And so, you know, between Stanton, you've got Kevin D. Randall and Don Schmidt and Linda Moulton Howe. They're really out there in the front, bringing a positive and journalistic face to this phenomena. And so it was just crazy. People were really open to believing this. Talk show hosts had alien abductees on their shows. Sightings was a very popular show. I love that show. Yeah, by the time I was, you know, an early teen, I was all in on whatever was going on. And I just, you know, I think once it kind of grabs you, it doesn't let go.
No.
Yeah.
You're absolutely dragged in, and that's it. You're off to the races from there, right? Mm-hmm. So about your sighting, to this day, have you ever went back and actually talked to that friend and talked about what happened that night?
Oh, yeah. I mean, over the years, on and off, you know, on a very rare occasion, it would come up. And most recently, it came up. I guess it was a couple of years ago, we had a conversation around a table. And, you know, his memory was not so much the UFO streaked across the sky from, like, one side to the other, but he remembered it more like it disappeared and then reappeared. So that's really an interesting point, because both types of eyewitness accounts are quite normal within, you know, the UFO research.
Right.
So, you know, which one was it exactly? You know, I don't know. I just remember what I remember. I remember going across the sky, you know, from one side to the other, and I remember a streak. So now it could be, and he might disagree, it could be as simple as, because it moved so fast that he blinked, right?
Yeah,
when just at that moment when it streaked across the sky, because it was super fast. And, you know, he didn't see that kind of light trail that I remember. But the fact is, there was something anomalous up there, behaving in a way that was clearly not a flock of geese. It wasn't a lightning bug. This isn't the Pine Barrens. We don't get, you know, swamp gas. So I think the closest explanation I could conceive of would be temperature inversion. But I'm not sure, because there were two different objects and they behaved independently of each other. And then when the one went, like, disappearing up into the upper atmosphere, that didn't make sense to me either. So I haven't found quite, you know, a satisfying explanation.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And the good part is that you actually had somebody with you. Like with my sighting, I had somebody with me to actually clarify that it was real and it wasn't just me seeing things. So it's absolutely great that you had someone with you to have your witness of your sighting too.
Yeah, that was your dad, right?
Yes, my dad, yeah. And, you know, because like I questioned myself, and it was like, thank God he was there, because I would have to this day questioned if it was real or not. So it's good to have somebody there to do that. So is that the only sighting that you had growing up, or that's just what put you off to the races, that one sighting? And
yeah, I mean, that definitely was the fulcrum point, you know, where everything just shifted.
Changed.
Yeah, so there was, I've had other strange experiences over the years, mostly when I was, you know, many years later. And, you know, I've had some psychedelic trips when I've had some very odd occurrences, you know, where two friends, it's like you're thinking the same exact thing at the same exact time, and you're seeing the same thing. And it's like, whoa, how is this happening?
Right.
you know, and a lot of people who've done psychedelics have had that experience. The closest I had to maybe an ET experience or non-human entity, you know, whatever category you want to put it in, I was in, I guess it was my late 20s, and I was kind of going through a phase where I was like really deep into metaphysical thinking and into the psychedelic research and all kinds of stuff like that. And I had a couple of dreams where there was this gray alien type thing. And I know it was a dream. You know, it wasn't like, oh, I was abducted. You know, it was just, it was a dream, right. But it was like this alien kind of was in the dream, and it was like sending me some sort of symbol. And it was, I think to this day, it's the only time I've ever woken up from a dream and felt like absolutely compelled to draw something. And so I drew it. And, you know, it was a circle, the triangle in it, yellow and blue were the primary colors. And I have it somewhere. I don't know where. And it was odd because there's a gallery in New York City called COSM that curates and showcases the artwork paintings of Alex Gray. And Alex Gray, his inspiration is all through his uses of various psychedelics, right, and meditation, and kind of his vision quests that he has, and then he paints that. And when, so we went to that gallery, and lo and behold, the buttons they were selling, like the symbol of the gallery, was like the same color. It looked almost exactly like what I saw in my dream vision with the circle and the triangle. And that was a very odd coincidence at best. And then not too long after that, you hear these things where people are like, oh, put your consciousness out there, CE5 or what have you. I didn't know the term CE5 at the time. But I was on a bus one time, and I don't know why I was thinking about this, but I was probably, you know, going through one of my periods where I was, you know, struggling with depression or anxiety. I went through a lot of that in my late teens to mid 30s. And that moment, I put my intention out there, and like, if you're there, show yourself, you know?
Right. Yep.
And then, you know, I'm looking out the window, and then this light kind of appears, like a bright star or an orb or something. And I kind of got goosebumps in the moment. Whoa, is this really happening?
Right.
And then it disappeared. And now it was a little it was hazy that night. I don't remember being like densely clouded, but it was hazy. So, you know, there was a part of me that's going, all right, well, was it a tower light that just, you know, coincidentally appeared in my vision? And then, you know, was obfuscated by haze or something like that. But, you know, then I kept looking. I'm looking below. I'm like, you know, looking for a base for the tower. What could have been? Could it have been a plane? I don't know. It was just a very odd coincidence. But in the moment, it felt meaningful. So, you know, whether it was some other kind of consciousness or not.
Right. Well, it's like we kind of talked about the gut feeling when I was on
your
show.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You get that gut feeling and it means something. You felt that it was influential. It meant something to you. So, and mm-hmm. usually we're right on that gut feeling like we talked about. You know, and if you're looking around for stuff and you can't really replicate it again, you know, it probably was just for you, you know.
Yeah, you know, that's the interesting thing, the replication. So generally the scientific method calls for, you know, verification by repetition.
Right.
So can you repeat your results? And the problem with everything, not just ufology or, you know, it includes paranormal, anything, is that there is no control. There's no way to have put a set of controls in the study of UFOs, because if they are controlled on their end by sentient beings with their own free will, they can do whatever the heck they want. They can change their patterns up. They may very well be aware that we're looking for them and studying them. And so they can adapt and shift. And it's like, there's no way to say, okay, this UFO is going to show up at this time every, you know, night for the next so many years. And right. when it comes, we're going to have all our sensors and cameras going and we're going to capture this. It doesn't work that way. You know, it's not mindless. Right. You know, the paranormal researcher puts it like this, that let's say you want to do like an EVP and you want to record an EVP. Well, basically what paranormal researchers do is they just turn on the recorders and hope for the best, because it's like if someone was going to, if you're hoping to get a phone call from a family member, right? Like there's no way you know when they're going to call or how they're going to call. You just turn on your EVP and hope for the best. And they may call, they may not call. And that's pretty much what the study of this is. That's the frustrating part of this study, studying this phenomena. It's like,
yeah.
that, you know, the scientists are saying, give us the data and evidence, and they won't listen to us when we say, we could use more of your help because this isn't the rotation of the Earth. You know, this isn't like your...
You can't calculate it.
You can't calculate it. There's no ebb and flow. There's no exact rhythm. And there are flaps and waves where there are clusters of reports that occur over a period of time. But even those, you know, UFOs that appear, they come and go, you know, at random, or seemingly, at least to our, you know, perception, at random.
Right.
So that's why independent researchers and amateur researchers are extraordinarily important, because it's like, until there's enough funding or until you get enough scientists to take this really seriously, someone has to collect as much data as possible. And that's what you do and other researchers do.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we'll make sense of it later, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, that's the end goal, right? You know, but at least we can put something together in the meantime to actually have that data when it does come time, you know, and kind of get a better understanding. I think that's what we're all kind of focused on now. Whether we can't get the whole picture, but at least we can kind of understand a little bit of it, you know, and get that understanding there. But you're going to be doing that soon too, as well, right? You said you're thinking about joining MUFON, right?
Yeah, I am. I'm in the process of studying.
That's it.
So right. hopefully we'll get there soon. In the next month, I'd like to hopefully take the test.
Right.
That's the plan, at least.
Awesome.
But there's just been so much going on between that and work. It's been
I wouldn't busy. Rush it anyway. I would take your time with it. You know what I mean? That's what I did. I honestly took almost a whole year just to study and watch all the documentaries I could and you know, learn how to investigate properly and how to do psychology and interview a witness, you know, kind of. So take all the time you need. I never tell anybody to rush through it, you know, but it's great that I'm going to have you on as a colleague, you know, not only a friend, but soon to be a colleague, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah. I do want to get it done before it's, you know, winter. So
absolutely. Yeah.
I prefer my first field investigations to not be, you know, in training, not be in the middle of like January.
Right.
When it's like, you know, 20 degrees outside. But you know, I get it. I definitely won't rush, you know, quality is more important. And, you know, it's funny because I've been, you know, talking to you separately, but on Twitter, I'm noticing this younger community that is coming up. And I think many of them have been turned on to the UAP UFO phenomena because of what's happened over the past 5 years with the, you know, now To the Stars Academy and ATIP. A lot of them, two things. One, it's like they're almost completely unaware of organizations like MUFON doing the field work and investigations. And of course, there's other people outside of those organizations doing their own independent studies. But they're also unaware of support for those that are experiencers.
Yes.
You know, and there's just a lot of time spent on conversation, philosophizing, speculation, debate, which is all super healthy, and I encourage it. But for me, I got to a point where I was like, I want to do the work.
Right.
You know, like I want to get out there and I want to, you know, see, go into the field myself because I feel like that perspective. I've been podcasting for years, and it's been extraordinarily rewarding, you know, and then you're doing your own reading and research and that sort of thing. But I don't know what it's like to go out there and actually, you know, do that. And so
right.
to me, that I hope that it'll be like an enriching experience that give me a little more depth,
right?
You know, as to not just what experiencers go through, because I get to talk to experiencers all the time, but the process of gathering information, and I respect that. I really do. And I wish that there were more people that are younger and coming up that were aware of this. So, and number two, the problem is there's a lot of, and this includes, you know, some very good friends of mine, you know, there's a lot of, you know, negative talk about MUFON and whether it's been corrupted or infiltrated by, right. you know, CIA, FBI, you know, the cabal, or, you know, deep state, whatever it is. And look, it's totally possible that there is someone in the CIA that's in MUFON.
Right.
That is totally possible. Same thing with NICAP, although less likely because it was, you know, pretty much run by the Lorenzans. But the same, you know, same thing with all these organizations. You can have, what was J. Allen Hynek's?
Right. You got the National UFO Reporting Center, the Center for UFO Studies. The British UFO, you know, organization over there in the UK. And I'm sure if they wanted the information, like you said, they're going to have some CIA people in there because they want the information. It's just like we know that they're within the media force, mm-hmm. within the nation, you know, and they kind of control the narrative of certain things. Mm-hmm. So you got to expect it. You know what I mean? And like I was saying to you when I was on your show, is that every organization has a bad egg or two. It's just life. It happens.
Mm-hmm.
But you cannot judge an entire organization on a handful of people, you know?
Yeah. And I know this probably sounds controversial, but some of the concerns are, well, they're getting all this data from MUFON that they're collecting on these individuals and on the cases and blah, blah, blah. And my thought kind of is, well, okay, let's assume that's true. If that's true, then that means whoever they are is interested.
Correct.
Sincerely interested. They're not looking at, oh, these are a bunch of kooks doing crazy stuff. You know, they're sincerely interested in what's going on, what data is being collected. The kind of interest that we all say we want the government to have, right? Publicly, of course. So if they are doing this in a clandestine way, maybe it is a good thing.
Right.
That they're looking at. And look, a lot of that data, I mean, I know there's a lot of private data, but a lot of the data that MUFON and other organizations put out there is public. Like, you can go on the New Forks website,
exactly.
and look at all these reports,
exactly.
and show the person's name if they want to be anonymous is kept anonymous and that sort of thing. But most of the important information is public.
Yep.
Yeah. So I'm not sure what, other than the dishonesty aspect of it, I'm not sure what, like,
yeah.
malevolent.
I guess what happened was that this year, the director of MUFON, he started going to Washington to kind of talk to, you know, representatives, senators, all that kind of stuff. And he actually wound up having some really good talks, and they invited him back to Washington, and he wound up having like 15 to 20 different meetings with people on Capitol Hill. And what they did now is they're now having MUFON kind of brief them on how to investigate the UFO phenomenon. And people are taking that and twisting it, instead of just saying, yeah, MUFON is trying to help the government and how to do this properly. They're trying to say that MUFON's working with the government to give them the information, which is not true. It's just funny how when things happen, people can twist a little word and then it makes it look like a whole different situation, you know.
Right, but that's my question, is what information do they think they're giving?
Right, it's all free. It's like, if you're a member, you can go right on there and check it, so it's not like it is hidden. Right, you're right.
Right, I mean, yeah, and like I was saying, I mean, there are certain data that are kept for the public to protect the you know, public outing or scrutiny of witnesses who don't want their names to be known or don't want their, you know, addresses online and all that kind of stuff. So okay, so if they trust one org and then another org gets some of that information, like the government, I can understand being a little like concerned or disgruntled, but
of course,
you have to prove that first of all, you know,
absolutely.
Yeah. So it's still speculation at this point.
Yeah. It's a big thing, yeah. But,
not enough to detract me from wanting to join.
Absolutely.
You know, and do the work. I want to be part of that organization. I think that's fantastic.
Right.
Cause we need that. Otherwise, you know, there's different pillars of ufology and each one is very valuable. But if you don't have people going out and doing field case investigations, you don't have much to build on. Imagine if nobody researched the Travis Walton case in person and went out there and talked to them, and we just left it up to journalists and the government.
Yeah, you wouldn't know about half the people that were involved.
Right. Yeah. Like, and so a lot of that retroactive research that people do when they write, you know, books and whatnot, they're relying on case studies and whatever interviews and what have you were collected up until that point. So it's all cohesive and each part has a part to play, but in the field, like that's like the bread and butter.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, that ran us right into our break. So I think we're going to go ahead and do that, take some commercial breaks, and we'll be back afterwards. And we'll kind of dive into your documentary that just is out now, Half Light, which I watched yesterday, and it was absolutely amazing. So we'll get into that, and we'll be right back after these commercial breaks. Looking for some new shows to listen through throughout the week? Well, check out our brand new sponsor, ERRT Radio, which you can find on YouTube and the Mixler app. There's multiple shows every week, new ones that have just started, so go over and check them out. Again, that's ERRT Radio, the official sponsor of our show. Are you looking for some new swag? Well, UFO Encounters Worldwide now has an official clothing line and store where you can get your official merchandise. It's storefrontier.com/UFO Encounters Worldwide. You can select from a large variety of all kinds of gear, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, masks, can cozies, and more. We'll be adding more designs as time moves on, but there are two amazing ones on there now. And if you're looking to also support the show, you can sponsor to our PayPal and donate if you like. If not, that's okay too. Check out our swag store. Again, that's storefrontier.com/UFO Encounters Worldwide today.
UFO Encounters Worldwide wants to hear from you. Have an experience or a sighting you want to share? Contact your host, Jesse Peek, at UFOEncountersWorldwide@gmail.com today.
Hey, did you know UFO Encounters Worldwide has an official website for the podcast? That's right. You can go to ufoencountersworldwide.wordpress.com today and check out all of the cool content we have on the UFO phenomenon. You can get all of the content and information for each episode on the website. Plus, you can follow my travels and see some of my work. There's even new weekly updates on the UFO phenomenon with megalithic structures and different places from around the world with UFO sightings. That's ufoencountersworldwide.wordpress.com. Check it out today. Have you or someone you know had a UFO sighting and experienced some kind of electrical malfunction? Well, we have good news. We have started a project called Project BatTech 404. battery technology, and 404 stands for an error code you get with technology. You can report your UFO sighting that experienced electrical malfunctions at battech404researchmembers@gmail.com. You can also check out the official website, which explains all of our goals that we're looking to accomplish and how it's going to benefit the UFO community. This is a public project, so we also share the cases we have researched for the project. The website is projectbattech404.wordpress.com. Check it out today. And if you know somebody that has had an encounter, please email us so we can help the research and the data grow. Thank you. All right, welcome to the second half of UFO Encounters Worldwide, episode 63, with our special guest, Alan B. Smith. So I wanted to get into this half of the show. You're a documentary filmmaker, and you just had a pre-screening for your new documentary called Half-Light. How did the pre-screening go?
It went really well. It was the first in-person screening of the documentary, which was just so cool. Because we've been in lockdown for how long, and past year we've been out again. But so the documentary was made during that period, and I had previously posted it online on my YouTube channel, the first cut, and so I've gotten great feedback from that. But the cut that we that'll be on YouTube and Amazon and other places is a little bit slightly more refined, and what was screened a couple of days ago at Mainline MUFON, sponsored by run by Jennifer Stein, who was an amazing, amazing person. She's the director of Travis, the documentary.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so much gratitude to her. It was the first cut that I had released, not the one that I had cleaned up a little bit, and so I was a little nervous because there were some things that I knew were different. And it was so cool, man, to like hear people kind of go, oh, you know,
right, yeah.
or like shake their heads, you know, yes, like in agreement, or to laugh, you know, at moments when they should be laughing, right. You know, when it's supposed to be, you know,
to see that moment. Enjoyment about your own film, you know,
yeah, so gratifying, it really was. And I, because I'm well aware that considering the subject of the documentary and the fact that it was all done virtually except for a few in-person interviews, like there's no on-site locations, right? We're not running through the woods with cameras. We had no budget, like using a computer from 2011, outdated software, you know, glitchy. And, you know, it was just a passion project. But it was so nice that people could feel the heart, you know, behind it, and not everybody's going to get it, not everybody's going to like it, and that's cool. But it's for the people in the community, it's for experiencers, and it's for people who are unfamiliar, because I really want people who think that this is all just, you know, kooks and wackos to be like, look at these people that not only have they had, you know, these reported high strangeness experiences, seeing shadow people and ghosts and near-death experiences, UFOs, alien abduction, hybridization of their these children on board these alien craft of their own babies with extraterrestrials. I mean, weird stuff. And then they also have in their life real trauma, really hard crap that they have to go through, like all of us do.
Yep.
And in both cases, they come out learning something. And oftentimes those experiences, what they learned, feed into each other. And they grow as human beings. And then they end up being like very spiritually interested and evolved emotionally and well-adjusted. And functioning in society, and if you met them on the street, you think this is a cool person. These are nice people. They're intelligent people. You know, that's what I want the layperson to be able to see. Like, even if you don't totally believe, you know, their encounters, at least give them the respect,
right?
You know, of being well adjusted. People who have gone through trauma, they worked through that trauma, still dealing with some of that trauma, you know, in some cases. I mean, certain tragedies that happen to us in life, they, you know, they never go away. It's always a kind of a part of who you are. But to see these really cool, beautiful, smart people.
Yeah, people that are program directors and like people that are in good positions in the communities that are dealing with this. And, you know, you wouldn't know it unless you hear the story like that. They would seem like normal, complete people, which they are, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a huge part, I have to mention, of the emotion behind the editing process and the film itself is the music by Septembrio. Septembrio, I've been using their music as bumper music for years. Michael Hill is a really great artist. And you know, there are songs in there that it's just his music somehow relates to paranormal so well. And so, right. And just like human strife and human exploration of one's relationship to reality, you know,
yeah,
to love and to all these concepts that are built into the film. And his music is so central to some of the key moments in the film. So I just want to put Septembrio out there on the map for people if they're interested.
Yeah, I mean, I watched your documentary yesterday and I was absolutely thrilled with it. It wasn't, you know, a lot of the documentary filmmakers today will do the same old thing and it kind of gets boring after a while, you know. This was different. This was, like you said, showing that how normal people, everyday people are affected by this phenomenon and you wouldn't even know it. And how well they're doing in life and just the people that came forward, how they explained their experiences and that weren't kind of like shoving it onto you. They were just telling you from their opinion what happened to them. Mm-hmm. And sharing that they believed what was going on was real to them and they're dealing with it on an everyday life experience, which was great. And I think the music, like you said, the music really played into a lot of different aspects of the film to make you feel that emotion as the individual was telling the story, like where there's a couple different people who had lost some people and they're throughout their life. And the music, mm-hmm. would, you know, it was very emotional, the film, as well as influential and informative. So I thought it was absolutely amazing, in my opinion.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate that. You know, I think because we didn't have a budget, we couldn't fly around the country and do really cool. You know, we're not Hellier. And they had a super small budget, Hellier. Right. But I also have a full-time job, so I can't easily go around, you know, traveling. And so I had to be, okay, well, why do I love this community? Why do I love these people so much? And that was like the what started this whole thing. That was the seed. It was like a love letter to the paranormal people, to the community. And I think anything you do, like if you put your heart into it, and if you're honest with yourself, like when I was editing it, you know, there's times where I'm struggling. I'm like, oh my God, this is not, I know what I'm feeling, but I'm not feeling it on the screen yet, you know,
right.
And you're going through that process of, cause it's 15 hours of interviews that like you, after you're finished with these 15 hours of interviews, you have to go through, like I typed out my own transcripts of, you know, rough transcripts, more like bullet points. And, you know, then I have to go back through, read through those, each individual, and try to figure out how to weave it together in a way that makes sense. Because sometimes, it, just like many things in life, you can't express in words exactly what you're feeling.
Right. Well, you said it yourself, 15 hours into an hour and a half film.
You know? Right. Yeah, exactly. It can't be a 15-hour documentary, you know. That would get boring. Like if it's just someone, you know, talking, which was the fear, because this is just a bunch of people talking about their stories and it's the relationship. It's the encounters, these fascinating encounters that they have. That's what makes it interesting. So you kind of have to distill it into something that keeps someone's attention. And like, I'm so aware that it's an hour and 20 minute documentary. I mean, that for this type of documentary where you're not going on site, where you're just interviewing people, that's really hard to keep people's attention.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and did that well. I mean, even the kind of you know, you had the astronaut in different positions and like the stuff in between individuals speaking. I mean, you did that well, just as you know, of any big screen film, and played it right into the next. So
thank you. That's some low budget special effects right there.
But it worked. How did you do that?
So basically what I did was I dressed up as an astronaut.
Really?
And I filmed myself. And then for all these little, you know, these vignettes. And then I ran it through like all these, I just kept experimenting with effects and with frames per second until I could, you know, figure out something that looked almost like a stop animation kind of a thing rather than, you know, just someone dressing up in an astronaut costume. So, because my original idea would have been to have someone animated.
Right.
Okay. Right. And I would have done more actually with the astronaut. But like I was saying, like the equipment I'm using, it's so dated, everything takes forever. So I cut it down to really only several, you know, spots where I use the astronaut. But yeah, the astronaut was kind of like supposed to be a reflection of not only the individual telling their story, but kind of like the every person, you know, so representative of the audience and the experiencer and kind of, you know, chapters and bookends for this.
Yeah, because I questioned, I was like, how did he get this astronaut to do all these things that represent someone's story in between? I was like, how did he do that? How did he find the same astronaut doing all these different things? So that explains that. Pretty neat that you found that you were able to do that and make it look animated like that.
Thank you, Ed. It took a lot of trial and error. That's the other thing Jennifer Stein brought up recently as a documentary filmmaker herself. There's a lot of time. I mean, a lot of time. Where you're just looking online, trying to find the right B-roll, like out, you can spend hours for like a 10-second B-roll. It's crazy because, you know, especially when you don't have a budget, you're just like looking for as much material that's affordable or free that you can use. And then you record whatever else you can, like the astronaut for me, for instance. And then you're just experimenting for days and days and days, trying to figure out how to make something that you have in your mind work without having to hire someone, you know, to do it for you. Mm-hmm. So next time, I'm never doing a documentary again until I have a budget man. Someone could give me like a budget, like here, spend this on special effects. Right. Cool.
Right.
So it'll probably be a few years, I think, at least before I do something else.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm definitely gonna be looking forward to it because this one was good, you know, and you've also done other work though, too, right?
Yeah, well, you know, see, it's funny. I've only done two documentaries, both co-produced with my wife, and both are just passion projects, you know. Okay. So the first documentary was Born Equal, which we started around 2009, and it was after Prop 8 was passed in California, banning, was it California? I've been banning gay marriage. Now I'm confused. Or was it Texas? Anyway, I can't remember now. But, you know, we were like so upset about that because, you know, we have gay, you know, LGBTQ friends. And I was very passionate about that. And so we set out to do this documentary about, well, why? Like, why are people having such a hard time with LGBTQ people? At the time, it was just LGBT,
right?
Lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. And, you know, and does it even matter? And so the film actually takes it from mostly from a spiritual perspective. So there's a lesbian couple, they have children. Classic case of because, you know, they're older generation. They married men, because that's what they were supposed to do. They were afraid of being themselves. They had a family with somebody they didn't love, not in the same way, right?
Right.
And eventually these two women found each other, and you know, they made that sacrifice of having to divorce and then bring these two families together in this really unique way. And the children were really beautiful children. And everyone in this family was, you know, spiritual or Christian. And then we also look at it from a Wiccan point of view. We look at it from a Hindu point of view. We look at it from an atheist point of view. We looked at it from Judean and Islamic points of view that are all saying, look, there's nothing really wrong about this based on our religions. It's really just about how you want to interpret something and what matters the most. Is it love or not? And that's the one thread that is exactly the same in both of these documentaries. It's like this thing about love and connectedness is so important. And those are messages that we often get from experiencers too, how important that is. Like, gotta just let go sometimes. Like,
yep.
You know, it's like the old, I think Wiccans have an adage. It's like similar to the golden rule. It's do no harm, do as you wish. Like, I don't care, man. Like, do your thing, right. Whatever it is. Like, even if you don't understand something, right? Like, just let it go. Let someone be. They're not hurting you. You know? So that's really important to me personally.
Yeah, I mean, I follow Buddhism. My mom is Wiccan. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah. My dad is just, he's just, you know, he has a higher spirit or higher being that he looks up to. Nothing specific, yeah, yeah. But I mean, we all live in the same household, you know, mm-hmm. And we get together. Great. It's just, you know, a lot of people say, you know, what's Buddhism religion about us? Like it's more of a way of living life, you know? So, and the Wiccan is too, it's just appreciating earth and what we have here, you know? Mm-hmm. So most of it's all based on positive things, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's funny you said that. Cause yeah, there are also Buddhists in that documentary too, two of which were a couple. And they just have the best energy, like just so, so cool.
Yeah.
And I was, they just exemplified, like, look, these are two healthy, fun, kind Buddhist practicing. Both were monks, what's the word I'm looking for? That. But anyway, they're, you know, living together and, you know, practicing. If you see this, it's like, how can you hate anybody? You know, how can you right. want to deny? It's like experiencers, like, don't deny them their reality, you know, that's very painful and very hurtful. That's what upsets me the most, the way, like, I'm totally for comedy. Like, I'm not a woke person in the stereotypical way that we hear about it now. Right. Like I love Dave Chappelle. I love pushing the boundaries. I love edgy philosophy and humor and pushing culture as far as it can go to question itself, to challenge itself, to grow, you know?
Yeah.
But one thing that bothers the hell out of me is the anal probe jokes. Like, can we not do those anymore, man? Like,
yeah, they're not really. Yeah.
It's just like, it's so demeaning. It's so demeaning to people who have real experiences.
Yeah, to the ones that actually had it done to them. You know what I mean?
And could bring back
that whole trauma. You know what I mean? And make them relive the entire experience again.
Exactly. Well, and think about this, right? So now let's say you were a rape victim. And someone made a joke about that.
Right.
Right? Like, would you laugh?
Probably not. I'd probably be thinking about what happened to me.
Right. And would a comedian even make that joke? Do we even see it? We don't.
Right.
Because they know that, you know, I mean, there might be some comedian that makes some kind of loose joke around it, but for the most part. You know, people don't do that. Comedians don't do that. And right. And it's like, because you know, that's wrong. That's messed up. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
I think most of the negativity from people these days, it comes from them being scared or not knowing something. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying I'm scared, they'll go ahead and they'll dish out ignorance or being rude to somebody.
Because
it's not something that they're used to and they're weirded out by it, or they're jealous. Most of the time it's jealousy as well. And just people not knowing how to be a happy person in life, you know?
Again. Yeah, yeah.
So it's those kind of people, the ones you want to stay away from, unless they're willing to, like, you know, fix themselves and try to come over to the positive side. But, you know, that's why you kind of keep your tight-knit little groups, because it's better that way. It's more positive. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah. So you also do podcasting. You just rebooted Coffee and UFOs, which I was just on the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have your other podcast, which is called what?
Paranormal Now. So Paranormal Now, I started years ago, about 6 years ago, I guess, 5 years ago, 6 years ago now. And that covered everything paranormal, which I include ufology into the paranormal, because growing up, that's what it was.
Right.
Like, paranormal was just anything that was not accepted as...
It's all connected in a way.
As accepted reality. Right, right. So I think it was a little co-opted by the proliferation of ghost hunting shows and the like. Unfortunately, people think of paranormal strictly like, oh, that's ghost stuff. Well, it's a lot more than ghost stuff. You know, it's spirituality, it's near-death experiences, life after death experiences, it's, you know, spontaneous combustion, Bigfoot, all of that. It's part of the
same. That's why I like the word high strangeness. I think that covers it all. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Paranormal, high strangeness, Freudian, preternatural, supernatural,
cryptozoology, Bigfoot.
yeah, exactly. And that's what paranormal now still pretty much is, but Coffee and UFOs originally was kind of meant to just be like a short form version of Paranormal Now, because Paranormal Now was 2 hours show. And what I decided to do was make Coffee and UFOs strictly about UFOs.
Okay.
And leave Paranormal Now mostly, you know, other paranormal topics with the occasional, you know, UFO topic. And because I really wanted a place where, like you do, you know, it's kind of like you're like welcoming people into your space and saying, hey, let's have a conversation about this topic, you know?
Absolutely.
So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to, because there's just so much going on right now in UAP and UFO research that I didn't like that my conversations would like skip weeks, you know? Like
doing
those shows would skip weeks because I've got something else in between scheduled. So at least Coffee and UFOs, it's like down that playlist, you know, all those topics, that's strictly what's going on up in our skies and in our waters too.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So I got a question. You know, out of everybody that you've interviewed over the years, who is your favorite interviewee?
That's a really good question. You know, I have to be honest, even though I wasn't at I wasn't as good of an interviewer, Stanton Friedman.
Oh, you got to interview him? That's awesome.
He was my first interview for Paranormal Now.
Oh, what a way to kick it off. Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah. And gosh, I mean, it's because, and I know there's all kinds of disagreements about Stan, but he was such an important influence on young minds. And on just the community in general. And he was a great spokesperson for UFO research. He got onto mainstream television, was able to debate skeptics on mainstream television. He was all over the media, writing books, doing hard, you know, he wasn't an in-the-field investigator most of the time, right? He was that pillar of in-person interviews or document researching.
Yes.
You know, going to libraries and going back through the records. And so he's a perfect example. It's like you don't have to be a field investigator to be enormously impactful on ufology. And for me, he was like an idol.
Yeah.
You know, like
always been that way for me.
Yeah. I don't think I could ever have a better interview than that because of that emotional, you know, investment I had.
Right.
And having that conversation, and he did come on again one other time with Kathleen Martin to get together, and that was super cool. I love Kathleen as well.
Yeah,
she's been on the show several times.
I have had her on.
Yeah, she's just so, gosh, she's so gracious.
Very nice person.
And obviously knowledgeable.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it doesn't hurt to be the niece of Betty and Marty.
No, not at all. That's awesome.
But I don't know, you know, after Stan, that's a
pretty big one, man. That would have been my favorite. Yeah, by far. The only other person that I wish I could have interviewed was Jim Mars. I really liked his work, his books. I've read the Alien Agendas, and then the Need to Know or something like that, another book. And they're absolutely amazing. His research blew my mind, you know. For sure.
Yeah, well, Jim Mars was a friend of my friend Ken Cherry, and Ken Cherry had a a radio show, an online radio show on the old Inception Radio Network called Epic Voyages Radio. And that's where I got my start, just guest hosting on his show. Okay. And because of their friendship, I got to interview Jim Mars.
Wow.
And it was probably one of my worst interviews ever.
Really?
Yeah, I was so nervous and so I was like a fanboy, and I was interrupting him. Not just my skill set at that point for interviewing was pretty poor. So right. So on top of me just being like, so oh my god, I'm, interviewing Jim Mars, this is so cool.
That's awesome.
It's probably one of my worst interviews, but I still really
did it. You did it. You got to have that interview.
Yeah, exactly.
You never forget that. But we have a minute left. You want to tell everybody where they can follow you at and keep up with everything?
That'd be great. Facebook, yeah, everything. Thank you. You can follow me on Facebook at Paranormal Now Radio, on Instagram, which is probably where I'm most active, next to Facebook, and that's at Paranormal Now. And then on Twitter, which I'm warming up to, I'm actually spending more time there now, that's at Paranormal_Now. But for like all the documentaries that I've co-produced, Life After, EVP, Sounds of the Dead, I've featured in Aliens versus Bigfoot, and my own documentary. Just if you go to Tubi.com and just literally just type in Alan B. Smith, there's only me and like one other Alan B. Smith, you'll see all the paranormal documentaries just pop up there, so you can check them all out there, including Half-Life.
Awesome.
And then of course the YouTube channel Mystic Lounge, so youtube.com/Mystic Lounge. That's where we do all our podcasts and shows.
All right, awesome. Well, I want to thank you for coming on today. I think we had a pretty good conversation, learned a lot of new stuff like always. And it's always a great time having a conversation with you. I appreciate you coming on.
No, thank you, brother. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And we'll definitely have you again on in the future. On again in the future, if I can say it right. and we'll definitely be in touch. Love to continue this relationship, this friendship. I think it'll grow. And as always, thank you again.
Okay. Thank you.
No problem. And I want to thank everybody for tuning into today's episode. Make sure you go and check out our sponsor, ERRT Radio, which you can go find on YouTube and the Mixlr app. They have a couple different weekly shows over there. Just started up a couple new ones. Pretty interesting stuff, card readings and et cetera. And next week, we'll be back with another amazing episode. So until then, keep your eyes in the sky. Well, I want to thank everybody for tuning in to today's episode 63 of UFO Encounters Worldwide. I want to thank Alan B. Smith for coming on and sharing the information and inspiration that came from his new documentary out that's called Half-Light. I highly recommend you guys go check it out. It's on Tubi and will be on Amazon shortly. It was absolutely amazing. So thank you again, Alan, for coming on today. Next week, we have guests Brian and Barry to talk about their brand new book from Flying Disc Press called The Deceptions of God and Men, which is also doing very good in sales, so it must be a really good book, and that's what I hear from a lot of people. So we'll see you guys all next week, and until then, remember to keep your eyes in the sky.